Hey everybody, Rob Maurer here, and today we have the good fortune to be joined by Eric Berger. He is the senior space editor at Ars Technica, also the founder of Space City Weather, and most recently, the author of Liftoff, which is the story of the founding and launch of SpaceX. So thanks for joining us, Eric.
Hey, happy to be here, Rob.
So the book just came out this week. I thought it'd be a great opportunity to talk to you about it, get some insight on, you know, Elon Musk, the founding of SpaceX. Even though this is sort of a Tesla podcast, we've been talking a lot about SpaceX over the last, you know, 6 months as Starlink potentially gets ready for an IPO or something of that nature here pretty soon, or in the near future at least. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about the process of writing the book? How long has this been in the works for you?
So it was about the time of the Falcon Heavy launch back in 2018 that I realized I'm a longtime space reporter and have covered that industry from NASA and everything else that goes with it. And SpaceX obviously had been a very interesting company throughout the 2010s, but them nailing that launch on the first attempt and then the landing the booster side by side, it was sort of a moment where I realized that this company is not just interesting, they're like transformative and the most important space company, certainly in my generation. And, you know, I really wanted to understand where they had come from and to figure out where they were going. And, you know, Musk had been aware of my work, you know, as much as he respects any journalist, I think he respected sort of my grasp of, you know, what was going on in space. And so I approached him several months later. And I said, look, I think it's time to write a book about the Falcon 1, and I'd love to write that book. Shortly after that, he said, okay. And so he invited me to come to the factory and interview people who were still at SpaceX who'd worked on the Falcon 1. He let me sit in on planning meetings for Starlink and Starship and Raptor and other programs to sort of see how he is, his management style in action. And also sort of his willingness to let me do with the book, which I had entirely editorial independence, but, you know, like I said, he sort of trusted that I would get the thrust of it correct. His willingness to let the project happen basically signaled to all of the former employees of SpaceX who may have talked to other authors or journalists, but maybe hadn't been fully candid about everything that happened. Sort of that was a green light that, okay, let's tell the story and let's tell it all. And let's try to be, his message to me was be accurate. So I tried to both be accurate and tell an engaging story, and it really turned out to be one hell of a story.
Yeah, I'm excited to read it. I haven't got my copy yet, unfortunately. It's on the way, but so basically you're saying that, you know, this isn't just like a let's shine the light on all the good things SpaceX has done. It's kind of going through the trials and tribulations of, you know, how difficult starting a space company or rocket company was, you know, a decade ago.
I mean, let's be fair, it is a good news story because the good guys, the physicists and engineers, win in the end, right?
But spoiler alert.
but they went through a lot of difficult situations, and Elon doesn't always shine, but there's no question that it was his vision, his determination, and sort of his just relentless drive to keep things moving forward that kept SpaceX on track. And you know, there were many people who wanted to be Elon Musk in space before Elon came along. More than a dozen companies had come along. I mean, the idea, he was not the first person to have the idea that there ought to be a UPS or a FedEx for getting satellites into space. It shouldn't be this expensive. It shouldn't take this long. And they had all failed for various reasons. And so SpaceX succeeded where a lot of other companies hadn't. And at the end of the day, you really have to put that down to Elon, who didn't just provide the funding. You know, he was there a lot of the time when he wasn't at Tesla. So 2 or 3 days a week, at least, making the hard decisions and keeping his teams focused.
So one of the things that, you know, obviously this is sort of a Tesla audience, I'd love to hear you kind of, you know, talk a little bit more about how people at SpaceX maybe perceives that balance, or, you know, how they work with Elon being a CEO of these two, you know, massive companies being, you know, drawing so much of his, or wanting so much of his attention.
Yeah, I think SpaceX employees take some comfort in the fact that Gwynne Shotwell is there. And she runs the company. You know, she's in charge of HR, legal, and she's been a steady hand. You know, Elon hired her back in August of 2002, and she has his complete trust. So on the business side, the company's in pretty good hands because she's now she seeks to disrupt the space industry every bit as much as Elon, but she's kind of a velvet glove, whereas Elon is Elon, right? He's out there saying things and doing things that are controversial and really doesn't care. She kind of feels the same way, but she's more, as I say, has a softer touch, shall we say.
A little bit more tactful.
But yeah, I mean, it's a huge competition for his time and his attention, because when Elon is around, things move faster. And so, you know, when Tesla was having their really big problems with manufacturing, I guess in 2018, 2019, you know, Elon, I think, was focused much more on Tesla than SpaceX. Now, I think that's switched around pretty significantly as Elon has gotten really focused on Starship over the last year, and he's spent a lot of time, you know, in Boca Chica. I visited him down there about a year ago, I guess in February of 2020, right before the pandemic really kicked off, and he was spending 5 days a week in Boca Chica. And so while I'm sure he was doing Tesla phone calls and conferences and stuff, he was hands-on in Texas with Starship, and I think it's remained largely the case since then.
And we were talking a little bit beforehand about just, the evolution of Elon's businesses in Texas and sort of how having a SpaceX business unit in Texas has really sort of opened his eyes to operating there, and maybe that's been related to, some of Tesla's endeavors there. Do you want to share a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I mean, he clearly likes Texas. He's had facilities here since the end of 2002, when they found the engine test site in McGregor, Texas. And he was very conscious about that site because there's lots of engine test facilities. These are rocket engines. Where you blow things up, and so you need lots of space and, you know, the ability to make noise, that kind of thing. And he, as you know, he likes to move fast. And there were lots of engine test facilities at Air Force bases, at NASA facilities. And he was really looking for some place where he could be independent. And this facility in McGregor offered that. And another reason why he built the launch site at Boca Chica is because the launch range in Florida is managed by the Space Force now. And again, it's pretty good at working with them, but it's regimented. Your schedule is dependent upon a lot of other things, whereas in Boca Chica, he can go his own speed. And so he's liked Texas, gotten more comfortable. So it doesn't surprise me to see him move operations from California for Tesla there.
So while we're on Texas, just a couple of recent events here. So yesterday, obviously, we had the SN10 test flight. Any thoughts to share on that?
Right. So the question is, you know, they've blown up three Starships in a row now. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And I think by and large, it's a good thing. Although you'd like to see them not blow up. The fact of the matter is, this is a very conscious decision to hardware development that he's chosen. And the idea being that the fastest way to get Starship flying is not to spend years and years doing detailed engineering, studying all the things that could go wrong, trying to mitigate those things, and then ultimately flying the vehicle in like 2024. He would rather fly, you know, less or lower fidelity versions of Starship, find out what's wrong. Because, you know, if your walls of your vehicle are, you know, 2 millimeters thick or 4 millimeters thick, right? You may have some engineering models that tell you you could get away with 2 millimeters, but to be safe, you should build it to 4 millimeters. But you're never really going to answer that question until you go fly it. So he'd rather not spend months and months assessing that question and doing tests in labs. Build the vehicle, go fly it, find out what your limits are, and then there you go. And he's able to do that because that program is more hardware rich than any other space program in history. It's really remarkable what they've done by building the Starship factory literally beneath tents in South Texas. Now, Tesla people know about factories and tents. And it was really interesting talking to him last year specifically about Starship, because this was after he'd been through the Tesla hell period, you know, where he did all those things. And he was very much of the mindset, not as much worrying about Starship, but building the machine to build the machine. He was very much concerned about processes and optimizing the factory so that he could produce as many Starships as possible. And building a spacecraft, the size and scale of Starship, which is enormous, every 2 to 3 weeks, let me just tell you, that is absolutely unprecedented and amazing to see them do that. And so he learned a lot of lessons from Tesla about factory optimization that he brought, you know, to Texas. And it's funny, and I know he had problems at Tesla in terms of going too far, you know, into the area of automation. So, you know, in Texas with rockets, man, it's just welders running around doing things in addition to the engineers. It's a nice mix of different workforce.
For sure. Yeah, it's super interesting to hear about. How much, I don't know if you got a sense for this at all in your conversations, but how much overlap is there kind of between like the engineering at SpaceX and the engineering at Tesla, and how much they're sharing some of the knowledge or even people?
I think there is some overlap in terms of the materials and things like that. But honestly, I think most of it's in Elon's head. Like, he's learning lessons from SpaceX. He's applying those to Tesla. He's learning lessons from Tesla, and he's applying those to SpaceX. And, you know, and I think he's growing as a manager too. You know, one of the things that really strikes me as amazing about what he's done with both of the companies is typically you have a visionary founder come in with some great idea that's going to shake things up. And you know, this person hires the initial staff, they get something off the ground, and then they go IPO, or they do something, and then they get a board of directors. And this, you know, the visionary sort of gradually steps aside. And that happened with PayPal to some extent. But it hasn't happened with Tesla or SpaceX. You know, he has been in both companies, you know, SpaceX for 19 years and Tesla almost as long, and is still, you know, the innovating force behind both of those companies on a daily basis. It takes a remarkable amount of energy, and it just speaks to his capacity, I think, to both be the visionary, but also sort of this hard charging, you know, leader of people.
So during those like really challenging times, as you mentioned, kind of 2018, 2019 with production hell, how was Elon's mood in the conversations that you had with him? Was he kind of, you know, steady, or was it visibly affecting him, or?
So I did most of my interactions with him in 2019 for the book, and, you know, but I'd met him before and have talked to him since. And, you know, sometimes he's in a good mood, in which case he's hilarious, right? You telling jokes. You know, he does this thing where he'll tell a joke and then sort of realize that it's funny and then kind of continue iterating on that joke or riffing on it for a little while. And then there's sometimes when something has set him off and he's in a bad mood, and that's, you know, that's less fun. Sure. And I've seen him in that mood. You know, I've seen him in that mood too. His interactions were good. You know, he does not like to talk about the past. He doesn't like to talk about emotions. You know, if you ever interview him, don't ask him how he feels about something, right? Because he doesn't want to answer that. Ask him about the technical details, because he'd love to nerd out about rocket engines or car engines or manufacturing processes, or I'm sure paint drying, you know, what have you. He'd love to talk the details. So I was a little, you know, trepidation, I think, is a good way to put it, in terms of getting him to really open up about the past, because these are things that happened, you know, 18 years ago, 15 years ago, and you know, a lot has happened in his life since the Falcon 1 days. But there was this really nice period of about an hour and a half where I was with him and three of his boys, who were 13 at the time, and he wanted them to hear about those days. And so he was very expansive about the Falcon 1 and some of the different things that they experienced. And that forms a really nice core of his, you know, remembrances in the book. And the book is not, frankly, just about him. It's about the company and it's about the people who helped him carry out that vision. But at the end of the day, I mean, Elon is SpaceX and SpaceX is Elon writ large.
Well, that kind of reminds me of the, you know, we were talking about Gwynne Shotwell earlier. I think a lot of Tesla investors have always kind of looked for someone like Gwynne Shotwell at Tesla. I think the book goes into a little bit of detail about how she came to be at SpaceX. Do you want to share a little bit on that?
Yeah, so he founded the company in May of 2002, and he had his principal engineers to start with. So someone to work on the engines, someone to work on the avionics or computers that would, you know, help the rocket fly, and then someone to work on the structure, so the fuel tanks or the structure of the rocket to support it. And he had a consultant who was kind of doing sales, and Hans Konigsmann, who was the vice president for avionics, was friends with Gwynne Shotwell. They'd worked together at a small company in California called Microcosm. And so she took him to lunch. And then after lunch, he invited her to come over and they talked for a little bit. And then after that conversation, I guess Elon realized that he needed a vice president of sales. And so he encouraged her to apply. And she had had a really interesting career because she'd started out in the automotive industry, actually at Chrysler, as part of their management program. And she'd become disillusioned with the automobile industry because, you know, at the time, and this was in the late 1980s, a lot of the cars were being designed outside of the United States. It was very much the Japanese were being very innovative with their designs, and the U.S. So like she said, like all of the design work was not happening at the Chrysler headquarters. It was happening overseas for the really tough stuff. So she ended up going in the aerospace industry and was kind of like, you know, so she'd had a decade and realized that when Elon talked about the fact that, man, that the price of rockets should not be going up, it should be going down and we shouldn't be using decades old technology. She knew it was ripe for disruption. And so she saw that in his vision, but, you know, she was like 40 years old. She was in the middle of a divorce. She had two young kids, you know, she was renovating her condo. And so she's like, it was just, you know, do I join this younger guy who has a good vision, but you know, as she was, had been around enough to know that these attempts usually failed. But she said, she told me she finally called him and said, look, you know, Elon, I've been an effing idiot and I'm taking the job. and since then, like they are, as I say, you know, they have different approaches, but they are simpatico in trying to disrupt things.
That's awesome. That's really good to hear about some of that background. What I guess kind of getting back into the book then, what did you find like most surprising and, you know, maybe different from what you expected going into the project?
You know, I think what I came away sort of most impressed about or most, you know, I took away is just how hard it was. Because you think, okay, today they're building rockets with 9 engines, with 27 engines. They've got this huge rocket in South Texas. The Falcon 1 was a small rocket. It was 68 feet tall. It just had one main engine. It really just needed to go to orbit. How hard could it be? Well, it was really hard. You know, a dozen companies had failed at what SpaceX tried to do before Elon came along. And so what I was really interested in finding out and didn't quite know when I wrote the book was, why did they succeed where these other companies had failed? And it's hard. I mean, they had luck, right? They had good timing. They came along when NASA was looking for something like what they were doing. But it's hard to get past Musk as the key reason for the company's success. And that's because A, he's really good at finding talented engineers and then identifying those who are willing to work extremely hard. And let's face it, he's demanding, can be difficult to work for. He has those bad mood days. But you know, he found them, got them to buy into his vision, and then was great at motivating them and keeping them going. And that's really what separates him, is he's got this internal drive. I think every day he wakes up and tries to think of, well, how can I do this faster or better? But mostly faster. Like he wants to go fast. And so when you see these crazy, you know, you always talk about Elon time, right? Well, we're going to deliver this model by such and such a date, or this rocket is going to launch to Mars. Then, like, in his head, he believes it. Like, if everything goes right, we can make this schedule. And it's not really realistic because the real world doesn't work that way. But Elon is trying to bend the real world to these schedules. And it was impressive. It's impressive to behold now, but it was the same back then. Like, it was just constantly, relentlessly pushing forward. And it's just something innate to him, I guess.
Do you have a favorite story or kind of detail that stuck out to you from the book?
There are many, but I think one that's telling is, so it's March of 2006, and SpaceX has spent nearly 4 years building its first rocket. It was going to launch from California, and it had to leave that base, Vandenberg Air Force Base, because of a conflict with the Army, with the Air Force and Lockheed and Boeing. And it ended up having to build a second launch site, Kwajalein. So they'd made this enormous progress, gone fast, and finally, it was the day that they were going to launch the Falcon 1 rocket for the first time. And so he's in the control center, this room on Kwajalein. The rocket's on a small island about 20 miles away on Almalek, and they're sending commands over there, and they're you know, it's fueled, it's ready to go, and they're within about 20 minutes of launch. And this is the culmination, right? He'd spent, you know, tens and tens of millions of dollars on this, invested lots of sweat equity. And a guy named Chris Thompson, who was the second employee hired by the company, he was in charge of structures, is the launch conductor. So, like, the commands that are being relayed to the rocket are going through him. So, like, he has this pretty important role in the mission, in the flight control room. And Elon keeps coming over to him or beckoning him back to where he is and asking him questions. And it's not about the Falcon 1 launch. It's about other things. And like Thompson said, they were having this really aggressive conversation about ordering aluminum and other materials that were needed for a Falcon 5, which, by the way, they never built a Falcon 5. And this was years into the future. But damn it, Elon was like, you know, he's always thinking ahead. So like they have this aggressive conversation, and Thompson, I think at some point finally says, look, you know, we're trying to launch a rocket here. And he goes back to his seat, and the launch director, Tim Buzza, turns to him and says, what the hell's going on? You know, but you know, so the point is that Elon is always looking ahead, right? Even at times when everything is to play for, right?
Right.
Who wouldn't be excited about the first launch of their own rocket?
Right. And that's like, you said 2000, that's like 5 years into the making, essentially, right?
Less than four. I mean, they founded the company in May of 2002, and this was March of 2006.
Yeah. But still, 4 years of culmination, and then it's like that day. If there's one day to just be singularly focused on one element.
Or at least the last 20 minutes before launch, right? I mean.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's crazy. Is there anything that you just didn't feel like would fit in the book or that didn't quite make the cut, whether it's like a story or, you know, more of a broad takeaway?
So the book is almost entirely encompassed by just the Falcon 1, because it's such a rich story, and you know, the beginning of the company through finally reaching orbit. So I only spent a little bit of time sort of on the last decade, and I had some pretty good stuff about the first launch of the Falcon 9 rocket, which happened in 2010. So I left some of those stories out. But I used a lot of what I had about the Falcon 1, because the people I were talking to were really eager to tell their stories, because a lot of the stuff had never really been talked about before, but they were kind of legends within SpaceX. And so, you know, a lot of it is in the pages.
I guess that kind of brings me into a next question that maybe you don't even want to think about at this point since you just wrote the book, but is there going to be a follow-up?
Maybe. I mean, I think there's a lot to write about in terms of the most interesting thing that's happened in spaceflight over the last decade is reuse of Falcon 9 first stages. And so I think there's lots of stories that could be told about that. So that's a potential topic I'd like to explore. And a lot of the people who I talked to about the Falcon 1 then moved into the Falcon 9 program So I have those sources. So I, you know, I think I'm going to take a little bit of a break, but that's something I definitely would like to explore in the future.
Nice. That's awesome. Did you see Elon's tweet about him writing a book?
I did. And I'll tell you that that came after I'd sent him a signed copy of Liftoff. So I think
like immediately after?
Not quite immediately, but I think I think he has things he would like to say. And I think maybe he's a little disappointed that Liftoff is as much about some of the other people at the company as it is about what he put in. Now, I will say the book gives him an enormous amount of credit, the credit he deserves. But I wanted to tell the story of the whole company. And so it includes, you know, people who aren't there anymore, but played a key role, or maybe there was some controversy. But I think Elon's book about his life, because I know he's disappointed in Ashley Vance's biography, which I think is a tremendous book. And in terms of reporting, it's an amazing piece of journalism. But Elon has, you know, wants to tell, I think, his story. At one point when we were talking about the book, he said, "Now I want to spend time with you so that I don't have to go do this on my own. Spend the time, because time to him is precious and valuable." So
yeah, and writing a book.
Writing a book and doing it right.
No, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And for him it would be challenging, because it would be spending a lot of time thinking about history, which and things that happened in the past, which he may not want to do. So he probably will do that. I know there's another author working on a book about Tesla. And I don't want to spill the beans on that, but I think that's forthcoming at some point and probably will be a pretty good insight as well. But I think Elon...
Yeah, I think there's like two or three in the works right now.
Yeah. I think Elon probably wants to tell his own story. But I have to say, I think Liftoff captures the essence of this SpaceX story. And all of the early people I talked to, because I gave them copies, the vice presidents and their assistants, are very happy with how the book turned out. And sort of capturing that esprit de corps, and just the desperation that they kind of went through to make it happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, I'm super excited to get my copy. Is there anything else that we haven't like brought up yet that you think might be interesting to note?
I guess I would just say that, you know, one of the things that the book really tries to explore is his Elon's motivations and the way he sort of managed his teams to succeed. And so if you're looking for insight into what kind of a manager Elon Musk is, or how he leads a meeting, or how he motivates an employee, there's lots of good anecdotes in the book that sort of really illustrate that, I think.
Awesome. Well, the link will be down in the description. Again, Liftoff, I think the story of, you want to give the full title there, Eric?
Elon, as Liftoff, Elon Musk in the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. I think that's it. I don't have it right.
Got him a mouthful, but yeah, we'll call it Liftoff. Again, the link will be down in the description for those of you that want to check that out. Eric, thanks for taking the time. This was a super enjoyable conversation. Really appreciate you coming on.
Rob, thank you very much for making the time. I appreciate it. We'll be right back.